Okay. So I want to thank first the organizers and Dan especially for giving me this chance to share my work with you. So I'm going to talk about some of this theoretical framework we have developed over the last 10 years in the sort of name of the landscape and flux, and trying to quantify the landscape and flux in this sort of theoretically and also experimentally, and see its meaning and also the implications for the biological system, especially the non-equilibrium biological systems. So I'm going to divide the talk into three parts. And first is sort of the introduction of this framework, and mostly about some of the physics, non-equilibrium physics involved, especially on the dynamics part. And of course, this will be complementary to Udo's talk on the thermodynamics. And then we're going to talk about a few biological application examples. And finally, we are going to march on to the experimental quantifications of these two key quantities that we're talking about, our focus on these in this talk. So of course, I don't have to give you too much motivations, because this is the topic of this, or the theme of this program, which is the cellular energetics. And in fact, most of the systems that are around us are non-equilibrium system rather than equilibrium system. I mean, although the equilibrium systems are better studied, at least in the textbook, undergraduate or the graduate level, and mostly like 80% or 90% of the stuff that we learned from the textbook are equilibrium physics. But although most of the systems that we are dealing with are around us are non-equilibrium systems. So that's sort of the motivation, how we are going to be able to look at the dynamics and the thermodynamics of the non-equilibrium system. And the important thing is that the equilibrium system, we have a very good tools, and we have in the dynamics, we have the Newton's law, and if we forget about the relativity for a moment, and the Boltzmann law, and so it's a statistical mechanics. We have a recipe. Once we know the interactions, we can essentially know the dynamics, and we also know the thermodynamics, and look at the equilibrium recipe of the partition function. We essentially have a way of characterizing the equilibrium properties. However, for non-equilibrium system, that's the sort of the challenge, and much less addressed in the textbook, and so, but much needed. So, for example, like cell, I mean, our subject, and it's a very fundamental unit of the life, and is certainly not in equilibrium, because it takes energy, material, and information always in and out, and that makes its function. On the other hand, even within the cell, to the intracellular networks, like gene regulations, that is also involved with a lot of activation process, signal transduction, or even at the gene regulation level, many activation processes are involved. And so these are the examples. So a lot of times, because of the rapid advances in the experimental techniques, like, you know, gene expressions, I think Professor Lai already mentioned that the RNA-seq and all these other things, high throughput. So that gives us some feelings about, for example, in the intracellular level gene regulations, we can look at different stages of the cells and look at its gene expression profiles. And that gives us some feelings about at least the characteristics of what's happening during the process, at least at the different stages. So if we have many genes, and that forms an n-dimensional, multi-dimensional state space, each gene or concentration represents one component of the vector And then you can draw a n-dimensional state space, right? And one point represents one profile, right? The gene A has certain expressions or the protein concentrations, as an example. And another gene has another values of gene expressions, and so on and so forth. So one point at this multidimensional state space represents a gene expression profiles, right, for different species. And then the question becomes, and if we abstract that to the physics, and then becomes how you go from one state to the other, right? In a multidimensional state space, you go from one state to the other. You look at the gene expression dynamics, you try to figure out what's going on, how it interact with each other, and how the dynamics changes with respect to time, and how it comes about, and how it's related to its function. So this is a cartoon picture of showing, for example, gene regulatory network. How do we study its dynamics? So this is the genome, and this is of course a very cartoonish picture. This is a genome with the different genes, and these different genes interact with each other, right? Activation or repression. And then we look at the gene expression state dynamics. So each gene has certain expressions, means protein concentrations in terms of that. So at one particular time, and each of the gene has certain concentration or expressions here, labeled here, the height represents the values of the expressions. So this whole collection represents one state, as I mentioned in the abstract n-dimensional state space, right? Because this is just represents one state gene expression profiles of many different genes. And another state in the state space has a different profile. So this gene might be here, and the gene expression values might be lower, and this one might be, has a medium value, but this becomes higher. So the whole cluster or collection of the state, the profile, gene expression profile becomes, for example, next moment becomes something like this. So this represents the evolution from one state to the other in the gene expression state.
In that space, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like intuitively there's no particular reason why you have to have some like continuous mode that kind of like you have to. I mean, you could kind of like go from here to there without going in between, hypothetically, right?
The question is, of course, I mean, if this is time equal to zero, this is time equal to t, for example, not like an immediate vicinity with respect to zero, then the question, of course, is one question is that how you go from here to here. It could be going like this. It could be going like that. It could be going.
It doesn't even have to be you could be here and then instantly appear. You know, it's not like a physical. No.
These are like protein concentrations, right? And gene expression, those are protein concentrations. And then it depends on what level we are talking about. If we talk about it, it's completely stochastic. You have the molecular number.
It's continuous.
But it doesn't have to be continuous, right? I mean, in other words, concentration.
The protein concentration. I mean, it depends if the molecular numbers is very small, right? Bacteria. I mean, then these are just molecular number, not a concentration. It's just molecular number. So you go from here to here. Yeah, there's some kind of stochastic jumps, yeah. So the evolution follows, stochastic jumps, discrete jumps, and the evolution will follow some kind of master equation, okay, right? Okay. I mean, so we can have stochastic Gillespie type of jumping. Yeah, go ahead.
X, Y coordinates?
These are just the of course, the two-dimensional projection of the gene expression. I mean, you can think about, say, for example, PCA, or you choose two major ones, and because we can't, because it's a multi-dimensional state space, yes. So, yes, go ahead.
And if a protein is, if a protein encoded by the gene is in different states, are those given different
concentrations? Very good question. Well, quite often people think, you know, people treat these two guys are together. It's called adiabatic approximation. It means that assuming that gene produce proteins and proteins regulate genes, but then let's assume that in many of the bacteria cases, this is true, that once the proteins are produced by the genes, they quickly regulate the genes. So in this case, they are always together, bind together, because they immediately, once produced, immediately bind. And this is so-called, physics called adiabatic case. And in this case, we don't have to separate the two. And this is often assumed. However, this is not the case. I mean, not the general case. So for example, in eukaryotic cells, and you have this DNA methylation, you know, histone remodification, all these time scales can add up, slow down the process. So it's not true, necessarily true, that once you produce a protein immediately, you will regulate, because you, I mean, eukaryotic, so you have to get into the nucleus and you have to do all of these things. It could be delayed. In that case, it's necessary sometimes to separate the proteins and genes into two entities. And then then this will be, you know, the enlarged state space. So one is the gene state, one is the protein expression, protein concentration, or protein molecular numbers. Of course, that there's another complication, because the gene states usually you say discrete, one, two, three, whatever. The proteins, well, I mean, depends. I mean, if you have small molecular number, discrete, but if you have a large number, like a eukaryotic cell, typically the protein numbers are reasonably large, and it's continuous. So you have like this discrete, continuous version of the complexity. But that's, yeah, that's very interesting, and there are some consequences related to that. Yes, go ahead.
So it could get even more complicated, though, if you have proteins that have post-translational modifications that modify their activity?
Absolutely. I mean, if you...
Active and less active.
Yes. So the time scale is important here. I mean, so if you, I mean, adiabaticity and non-adiabaticity will play an important role here. Yes. Yes. But of course, for some simplicity, we just, for illustration purpose, we just temporarily ignore some of the complexities here, just for illustration. So. Anyway, so our goal is to understand why it goes from here to here, right? Because you can, I mean, for example, from the experiments, you can look at, say, for example, the gene expression profiles here, like RNA-seq, at different times, for example, different stages, and you can have this profile. And you can ask the question, of course, this is not real time yet, because the real time takes much bigger efforts. Anyone understand why it goes from here to here? What's the reason? What's the driving force of going from this file to this file at a later time? And of course, just by looking at the network, even if you can solve this network, knowing the interactions and looking at that, there's not a very apparent way of understanding it, because then you can say, I just solved the Newton's equation, I got the results. I mean, this is, you solve the gene expression dynamics and you get the result, you say, okay, because you can say in general, because of this interaction, you get the result. Right? But that's not necessarily very satisfactory. Yes, go ahead.
Well, what is the mapping that you use to convert one of these states into a two-dimensional state? Why 2D?
Oh, because for visualization. Because we cannot visualize more than...
So you say that the distance reflects the similarity of patterns, but I mean, there are also things that when you project will be very close by that are in the state space, in the original state space, very far apart.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's for sure. What I mean is that this is just for you. I'm not able to draw like more than two dimensions. but essentially, it's a multidimensional problem from state to state. Yeah. Okay. So from what we have learned from equilibrium statistical mechanics, and then we will say that at least physicists will at least guess, saying that we're not going to be completely satisfied with this picture of saying just because of the interaction we can't get the result. We want to have a global understanding. And for equilibrium physics, we have such understanding because for equilibrium physics, we know the recipe. If we know the interactions, and Boltzmann law tells us that there is the probability of the states are given, essentially by the exponential of the minus of the interactions, the Boltzmann law. And essentially, the reason why it goes from here to here is because, for example, if this is a state over here, and this state is over on the downhill side, there's a global driving force by this kind of probability landscape. One has a higher weight than the other, so of course naturally you will go to the higher weight and the lower basin. Right? You see, if you have a global shape underneath this whole dynamics, then naturally you will explain why it goes down. Right? So for equilibrium physics, this is very natural. It's just saying you have a global landscape, and the reason why the evolution goes like this is because of there's a global shape behind that. So that seems to be natural. And of course, I mean, it just shows you. This is one representation, like a continuous representation. Of course, there's discrete representation, like a master equation. But even in the continuous representation, the continuous dynamics, this is a zoo. I mean, you can have zillions of these nodes and the zillions of the connections. You can just keep on writing all these differential equations and try to solve it. And that's sort of
You're previously talking about gene expression, but you're talking about calcium as well.
No. This is just an illustration of the network we are talking about. It can be gene network, could be protein network, could be many different things.
So yeah. I have a question.
Yes.
So those concentrations you have on the rate expressions, what do they represent on that network?
The node.
Is it the node or the node concentration in the node?
No. It's just the node. It represents the node. So these concentrations represent the node. Yeah. How node evolves? The node changes with respect to time, or the strength of the node changes with respect to time.
So each node has an amplitude.
Yes. That's right. Yeah.
I have a quick question.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
If I'm understanding you correctly, are the like underlying equations of motion, I assume that they're like not linear, but something like linear plus like product terms. And if
it's highly nonlinear. Usually it's highly nonlinear. I mean,
but it's made out of products, right?
It could be product. This is one way of doing that. I mean, there are people monitoring this with the Hill coefficient, that type of cooperativity. Then it's not necessarily product.
If it follows this, all of these adiabaticity protocols that you described, does it end up being like that?
Yes. So basically, you can. Okay. I mean, the way to see this. I mean, all these things emerge out. Is that if you look at the genes and proteins separately, right? And then you can say, for example, in the very adiabatic limit where it's very fast, and then use that, you can actually derive this equation. And the typical equations that it comes out from this kind of limit will be not necessarily the product. It will be mostly that Hill-like. With the cooperativity, because then you can incorporate the binding, like, you know, the dimer or trimer or, you know, all this binding into it, and then the Hill form usually comes up. You can do that, yeah.
To the earlier comment on each node having an amplitude, but you don't know a priori whether they all have periodic solutions, right? So they could be nodes which can decay.
They usually have a degradation rate, self-degradation rate. Yes, yes. Okay. That the proteins can degrade. Yeah. Okay, so let's look at the general equation, because this kind of thing, I can, the ordinary differential equation, nonlinear form, I can just abstract that into a mathematical form like this, right? I mean, this is, it looks very simple, but this is actually the basis of nonlinear dynamics. And the general way of looking at the dynamics of this equation is to do linear stability analysis around the fixed point. So you first find the fixed point, and then do the linear stability analysis around this fixed point. And then you can find whether or not they are locally stable. But that's the only thing you can tell. If you want to know the global information, because what we do care about this kind of network, I mean, now described by this mathematical equation, is to not only know the local property, you want to know the global property, where you're going, etc. The global information is not there by just doing this local stability analysis. What do I mean by global information? Is that suppose you have two fixed points, they are both stable and locally stable by this linear analysis. Then this local analysis doesn't tell you how you connect this to locally stable points. It doesn't. I mean, it only tells you, essentially, it tells you this local region, they are stable. It doesn't tell you how they connect with each other. So this kind of information is not there in the sort of conventional analysis.
So go ahead. I'm not sure I understand. Yeah. You're thinking of S as those like concentrations,
yes,
and, like, genes.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then, like, why is this necessarily like, you know, like just X dot equals this function? I mean, why not
higher
order derivative?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is it literally concentration?
Yeah. No, it's because the usual chemical rate equations just have the form like this.
Gene expression and other things?
Well, gene expression is the dynamics. It's determined by the chemical kinetics. The underlying is chemical kinetics.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, is that obvious? That seems to be.
Yeah, because that, I mean, if you accept that is
formally higher derivative is, you can always write the second derivative as first derivative has another derivative.
Concentrations.
Yeah, this is the concentration.
Yeah, but he's doing the very formal.
But if you assume that it's the underlying, the chemical kinetics.
I mean, it's lack of assumption, right?
Is the
the present state determines the future, and if you do too much cross graining, that will no longer be true.
Of course, if you have this kernel, that's a different story. Well, of course, I simplify things, because if you have, yes, as Udo said, if you have non-Markovian properties, then you were here have a comma with some kind of a kernel time. I mean, that makes things a lot harder. Okay, so go ahead.
For the dynamics to be deterministic?
Well, we can put a noise there. We'll see that later. Yeah, we can put noise or not noise. I mean, either way. Yeah. So as I said, I mean, this kind of I abstract all the things that we just mentioned into this kind of a simple form. Once we write down this equation, we can simplify, so we can think about that equation as a Newton's equation, but overdamped. X double dot is not there because this is overdamped. The friction dominates. We can think about that way. And then the physical interpretation of this this term right on the right-hand side, which determines the dynamics, is the force. Right? And that if this force is a gradient of some sort, right? I mean, if it's a gradient of some sort. And this is essentially the equilibrium stack map, right? You can follow the recipe because the two things very important. First of all the weight of the state space is determined by the Boltzmann relationship.
That's only if you have the nodes, right?
If I have, under the big assumption, if big E, and that, well, not only that, you know the weight of each state. This is a very important thing. If you know the weight of each state, then you can characterize globally, because I know the weight of this, and of course I know this weight of the state in each one, so I can connect this. So that's very important for global characterization. Immediately you get the global characterization. The other is the dynamics is determined by the gradient of this global function. The local dynamics and how you determine how you go from one to the next is already determined by that. So that if we have that, and then everything is easy, it's solved. You have a global driving force drives you down, and also everything is connected because you can go from here to here because they are connected by the weight of each state. Yes.
I mean, they are slightly contradictory, these two conditions, because if you have, in order to have non-zero weight at any state, you need noise. If you have noise, the second one is no longer strictly true.
Strictly true. I mean, so you could add a noise here. Yeah, sure. You can put a little noise here, put a noise here. You have a guiding force with some little wiggles. Yes.
Is it true so in general dynamical systems, you don't necessarily have this notion of equilibrium if you're not like ergodic, and if you're just not chaotic and not ergodic, could there be something like that with gene networks where some subspace of the phase space?
I mean, you're talking about things like chaos or things like that. Chaos, there are two kinds of chaos. One kind of chaos, well, it's very early on the development of chaos, and that's Hamiltonian chaos. So this has nothing to do with dissipation or anything. I mean, you can have a chaos even in the Hamiltonian system. But there's another one, which is the one that, you know, like our atmosphere, like weather forecast. That has the energy input to that. And that's a different kind of chaos called a dissipated chaos. So both chaos can, tidal chaos can have its counterpart in the network dynamics. You can have a chaotic solution, yes, but it's not necessarily have to be related to either equilibrium or non-equilibrium. Equilibrium or non-equilibrium, you all can have chaotic behavior. So that is the thing. So if we can have that, and then everything is resolved. However, let's have a look at an example of in biological system, this kind of thinking, whether or not it's working. And I will say that protein, I mean, on a small scale, the molecular level, it works well because you have the protein dynamics and the protein folding and the binding. And I think Professor Lai mentioned that. And using the energy function is very successful because we know the atomic details and we know the interactions. And so we can follow this recipe. We have global characterizations of the biological system pretty successfully in different systems. However, when we work to the higher level system, and for example, that the evolution, and actually the landscape idea first started early on in the biology is the evolution, the bigger system, and also the differentiation development, the Waddington, is Wright and Fisher. And they do use these ideas, I mean, in 1930s and 1950s. And And I would have to say the notion of using this landscape is somewhat misleading, which I'm going to point out a little bit later, because these systems typically are not equilibrium systems. So there are issues related to apply this idea directly to this. But of course, these are the physical systems, and this has been used a lot. So, and if we check, for example, the general gene regulatory network or protein networks in the cell, typically it would be great if we have that, but typically we don't have it. You can check any networks, and it doesn't have this property. It just doesn't have. Go ahead.
The global approach requires a potential landscape is more of a requirement for analysis, right? In order to analyze, it is good to have a potential field.
It also
Has it more fundamental than that?
Oh, the fundamental part is that you can understand, for example, if you have very complex, trajectories. I want to understand why it goes from here to here. And if you just say that it's a result of the simulations, that's fine. But if you say that there's a global landscape saying going down, and that gives you the mechanism, right? Why there's a global shape going down. That's why you are going next step, you are following the gradient of the whole state. Yes.
So, I mean, just repeating what I said, is it because it is easier to analyze, it seems, right?
Because for sure it's easier to analyze and in a global sense, but on the other hand, it will also help you to understand the mechanism behind, the global mechanism, not the local one, because it's not just saying, okay, this is the result of running the simulations.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to look at it with Navier-Stokes, right?
Yes.
And turbulence.
Yes, yes.
So it's not a totally potential formalism, because you also have dissipation, vortex.
Yeah.
So there's curl operators, solenoidal.
Yes.
So, and that global stability, still you can explain it in terms of physically what is happening. Mm-hmm. So that is why I'm trying to differentiate between the assumption needed for analysis versus the assumption needed for the, or the assumption coming from the physics of it.
Yeah, so for example, there are certain, I mean, of course, some phenomenology can be uncovered from that different kinds of analysis. But on the other hand, the things, for example, like Navier-Stokes turbulence, I mean, people typically talk about 2-point, 3-point correlation functions, right? And so you have the Kolmogorov, this loss, scaling loss, and the 2-point function gives you something, and 3-point function gives you more. I mean, the energy cascade. But what's important there is that first of all, these are like endpoint functions. What's important if you go beyond that, it will be the global distribution. If you know the global distribution, first of all, you can calculate all these endpoints. Yeah, this is that's one thing. The other thing is that there's some in the traditional analysis is something missing, which is this: there is a probability flow going around, and that's missing, and that's related to the time reversal symmetry breaking. So, but anyway, so that's we can talk a little bit more details on that. But anyway, so it's so then what can we do about it? Right? So that's the thing. So we came up with one way of looking at that. So let's see how we deal with that. If the force, the driving force, is not a gradient, it's not a pure gradient. So this is the same equation, right? So we put a little noise here now. And the noise correlator is given by essentially the diffusion, characterized by the diffusion strength. And then I can write down this sort of a stochastic differential equation, because they are not predictive, because the stochasticity, as Udo just mentioned, then tracing the each individual trajectory, you are not going to learn too much because it's just unpredictable because of the noise. However, one can look at the probabilistic version of that. This is nonlinear and also with the noise, not predictable in time. However, its probabilistic evolution equation is essentially characterized by this local probability conservation law, the change of the probability is equal to in and out of flux. And this equation has this in and out flux is determined by two things. One is the force, the driving force, and the other is the fluctuations. Now, this equation is linear. It's linear, so it's predictable. So although the trajectory is not predictable, the probability evolution pattern is predictable. So this is the equation. It's so-called Fokker-Planck equation in external force field. What's important here is that if we look at the steady state solution, right, steady state, so long time limit and partial p partial t is equal to zero, and then you get this divergence of the flux is equal to zero. And there are several different cases that we can discuss. One is that itself is equal to zero. If itself is equal to zero, you can move this to the other side. And immediately you get two things. One is that you can have, immediately you can have this potential function which is related to this probability distribution, but this is, remember, this is at a steady state, no flux means that no input and an output. This is the detailed balance condition, right? There's no input, and net input or output, detailed balance condition. And the force is the gradient. And so we up to now, we recover what we just mentioned, if the force is essentially a gradient force. So this is the equilibrium dynamics. On the other hand, this flux force, this flux, even if the divergence is equal to zero, this flux itself doesn't have to be zero, right? You can have a non-zero flux, but the divergence is zero, but itself is not equal to zero. So in this case, you can move this to the other side. Now you have two forces, right? You move this to the other side. One is related to the gradient of this potential. This potential is the minus log of the steady state probability, while here is the equilibrium probability to differentiate between the two, because this case the flux is equal to zero, detailed balance case, and there is a net flux, there is net input or output, so you have a gradient force. Now you also have a net input or output. So the force has a gradient component and also has another component which has something to do with the flux. And notice that the divergence of some vector is equal to zero means that it's rotational. I mean, if it's not it's not zero, because or not constant, because this is if it's electric field, this will be the charge. And if you have a charge there, then the force line will have to be going in or out, depends on positive or negative charge. But if the charge is equal to zero, then you have no place to go or to go come out, and then it has to be rotating around. So in fact, this condition for non-constant, non-zero flux, divergence equal to zero means that it has to be rotational. So what that means is the global driving force for the whole dynamics can be decomposed into a gradient, like what we are talking about before, and a curl, a rotational force. Right? So yeah.
Any vector field can be decomposed into a curl-free partner, a divergence-free partner.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not unique.
Right.
What singles out this decomposition from any other decomposition?
Okay, so basically what we do here is that, of course, there is some gauge degrees of freedom. So What we do here is in the limit where the flux goes to zero, I mean, the flux, the net flux goes to zero, then you actually, the requirement, it has to go to the limit where the equilibrium result is. So you go back to the equilibrium result. So that's the sort of the requirement.
Not every decomposition will have go to equilibrium when you go to flux goes to zero.
Well, you have some you have some freedom, so you can choose you make this choice that you have to be it has to be at that point it has to be equal to the equilibrium one the steady state.
Equilibrium then can't be zero, so the composition must be unique. So the rotational part is zero at equilibrium. So
yeah, approaching the equilibrium.
Yeah, so that the composition must be unique. So I don't understand the second term.
The second, he's talking about the second term.
Yeah.
So when you are at arbitrary flux, not exactly at equal to zero, I mean it's a finite flux. Yeah. There's a choice. I mean, so there's a gauge transformation so that you can you can have the one choice or the other. I mean, so you could have.
He's talking about the dynamics doesn't satisfy the balance.
I guess I was commenting on the fact that he said that this decomposition is fixed by the condition that in the equilibrium limit you want to recover the imbalance. But you would always do that because in the equilibrium limit.
There's a subtlety here also, which is that F curl is not a curl, right? Is not a curl.
It's not a curl because the J is a curl. Yes. So there's a this is a curl, and this divided by this, there's another. Yes.
So to make this decomposition, you need to know P.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know. I need to know P. Yes.
Yeah. Which also raises another question, which is that this isn't the P steady state isn't even guaranteed to exist for a generic F, right?
No, that's right. But for many of the practical cases, they are because you require this the requirement usually is that at a infinite places it dies out.
Yeah, you need to be coercive.
Of course. I mean, if for example, if you have a free diffusion, of course, you don't have a steady state, right? I mean, it's not true for all the cases, but it's true for the well bounded cases. Yes. Okay. All right. So what this means pictorially is just that you have not only a gradient, but now you have some kind of a rotational force globally when you look at the dynamics. You have a global gradient and global rotational force. So
why does it have to be global? The curl doesn't have to be global. You have vortices everywhere.
Oh yeah. No. What I mean is because this is a global flux, right? This is a global description. What I mean is that the gradient is that you have the weight of the state space, right? It's everywhere. The flux is also everywhere, right? When I say global, yeah.
So I guess there's something misleading between the connection between this slide and the previous one, which is that here you draw transients that go down to a fractal, while the previous slide wasn't the steady state, which.
No. I mean, decomposition, you can decompose. As I said, there are degrees of freedom. I can decompose that into anything I want. So I can decompose into steady state or time dependent. Right? It can be time dependent. I mean, this expression can be time dependent. The only thing is that if you decompose into a time dependent one, I mean, I can think about that as a time dependent one, then there's the flux is not rotational anymore. It's a J T, not a JSS. Yeah, you can do that, but the physical meaning, if you compare with the, you don't have a very easy connection with the equilibrium one. from that perspective. Yeah.
Sorry, but in time dependent, you have extra term, right? You have the dp, dt.
Yeah, because the p here, the p, I can replace the p with the pt, I mean, any time. But then this whole thing still works, except that the j doesn't have the divergent free condition. Yeah, this decomposition still works. The only thing that is not there is that, well, of course, the u is the minus log of p t, and this the j is also a function of time. But the j is not the divergence of j is not equal to zero.
Is the question by imposing gradient of j equals zero, but outside steady state, gradient of j is not zero. So I don't understand.
Uh-huh. No, here is the in steady state is of course is equal to zero, right? And this is the steady state condition.
Yeah, but if it's time dependent, then it's not steady state.
Right. So, but I can still decompose this way. I can still, I mean, this is just algebra. You move this to the other side right away, you get the answer. But of course, the j is not it's not divergent free anymore. You can just move this to this side if you have two terms. So,
sorry, yeah. Question. At some point, you have put logarithm of p.
I have what?
The logarithm.
Yeah,
log of p.
Yes.
Where did you get? Did that come naturally from the way you set up the equation?
Well, because the equilibrium analogy, because I like to have that log of p, because in the equilibrium is Boltzmann law.
I see.
I wanted to sort of have. Okay. So, I mean, the way to look at the non-equilibrium dynamics, the equilibrium we know is the gradient. So it's like charged particle moving in the electric field. And the non-equilibrium dynamics I can think about is the charged particle moving in the electric field and the magnetic field globally. I can see it this way. Well, there's another interesting part, which is that I can, this is the finite noise, but if I take the limit of the noise approaching to zero, and we can study what the property of this steady state function, which is the landscape part. And this landscape part satisfies the Hamilton-Jacobian equation, and we can prove that it's a Lyapunov function. So if it's a Lyapunov function, we can use that to study the global stability. This is the one thing that in the nonlinear dynamics, once you know the global Lyapunov function, you can use that to study the global stability. So that's one thing, one aspect. I mean, the equilibrium counterpart of the non-equilibrium potential has this property. Yeah.
So you don't need to take the noise to be zero to have a Lyapunov function for the dynamics?
No. You have to. Because it's determined by the Hamilton-Jacobian equation. If you don't take that limit, you are not going to have that property.
You can write an equation for dt mu or dt, you know, p, right?
That's the different one. That's the probability. You can construct the probability Lyapunov function. I'm not talking about that particular one. I'm talking about the non-equilibrium potential, especially.
But conceptually, it sounds like it would give you the same thing, right? I mean, what you want to see is convergence to the equilibrium distribution or the steady state distribution.
Right. There are two things. This part is about the trajectory, right? I mean, so you have the global convergence of the trajectory. That's the definition of the Lyapunov function. The other one, you talk about the probability, and you could design this probability sort of the global probability function essentially decay. So I would say for the zero limit, noise limit, you can use this, and for the finite noise, you use the other one, because this one will not work for the finite noise. Yeah. Okay. So that's some property. The other property is essentially something that you can characterize the path. As I mentioned, that not only you want to know the trajectory, what you are going to do next, But you also want to know how you go from one point state to the other. You want to characterize the path. So one can use so-called path integral representation. Now, not in terms of the equilibrium gradient force. Usually the path integral is formulated when you have this driving force as a gradient. Now you have the two components. One is the electric component, the other is the magnetic component. And what's interesting here is the following, that usually you go from one state to the other. You go through, this is the basin from one state to the other, because they are having higher weight and low basin depths, and you go through a transition state. And what happened is that this is the usual case where you have a gradient force. If you don't have a gradient force, what happened is that due to that rotational one, the magnetic field analogy, that it will, forward and backward path will not be the same due to the presence of that rotational force. And because of that, then you don't pass through that transition state, or it called settle point in the steepest descent path. So usually people, chemistry call the transition state, and physics call the Cramer's rate theory. This is a very critical point determining the rate between from here to here, right? Vice versa. And if you don't pass through this point, then we cannot use the old transition state theory. And because this rotational force of the in the dynamics, reflected in the dynamics, this is the optimal point on this path, and here will be the effective transition state. And the forward path and backward path are different, therefore the forward transition state and backward transition states are path dependent. So you can still develop a rate theory, but you need to determine where the transition state is. It's not given by just the landscape alone, because the synthesis of this. Yes, go ahead.
Just mean that the barriers are larger because you're avoiding the direct path.
Yeah. So you're taking a different route. So you have a different barrier. Yes. Yeah. So that's.
Are you making does it lead to the conclusion that this actually will make your transition rate to be smaller in general?
It's not necessary, because it could be that it really depends. I mean, so this could be has certain barrier, that, and this could be usually if you don't have any flux, then this could be a higher barrier thing, right? I mean, so if you go through here, this will be the minimum energy path. That will be the most efficient path. But usually, if you go this way, it's not. But why do you do this way? It's because there's a help because of the flux.
So the equilibrium way, you go through the barrier.
Yes.
But your driving force is a thermal fluctuation, so you divide by KT.
Yeah.
Now, in the other way,
the
barrier actually is higher, but you are driving by, you have active driving.
Yes.
Can you then understand as sort of, you have an effective temperature that's higher?
So I mean, in that sense, but it's not quite, because the effective barrier is something is a scalar. I mean, but this is a, and you can think about this. This is the effect is a vector. I mean, this is a vector potential.
So what I'm trying to get at is that, is there any way, based on your theory, to understand this active barrier crossing? I mean, you're not crossing.
This is an active barrier crossing.
But that does the height of S, whatever, this new S, play any role at all, or just all kinetically driven?
No, because here is, this is, when you determine this rate, you determine the rate based on the action. And this action has component of the gradient force and the
So the combination of those
give
rise to this.
So absolutely.
Help. So effectively, you're actually not just seeing the higher barrier,
but
you're actually lowering it by some...
Yeah, because you have the flow. You have the flow to help. Yes, go ahead.
I mean, this picture really makes sense to me in like a perturbative sense, right? I don't understand how... there's no notion of a barrier if you don't have you know, a landscape on which you're perturbing slightly, right? I mean, there's no barrier crossing. Like if I'm driving to
of course, I mean, yeah, I mean, so the, if you have the yeah, if you have a noise and which basically give you the fluctuation dissipation theorem, and so you have a small noise, and then you just sort of have an exponential rate and a sort of a thermal jump. Yes, I mean that's how you apply the equilibrium transition state theory at the first place.
This picture of red and yellow, that's just a log of the steady state probability distribution.
Which one?
The red and yellow there is just picturing the log of the.
No. The red and the white.
No, yeah, but at the red and yellow.
Yellow. That's here.
That's just the log of the steady.
Yes. Minus log of the steady state distribution.
You're just saying you don't pass through the most likely steady state probability.
Yes.
In physical transition.
Yes. Yeah.
But you still can make this active pass, right? You still write it as an optimum pass of some effective action.
Yes. But this action has that the right, rotational force.
Yes means in principle, or yes you have a formula.
I have a formula, but of course it's this. So okay. I don't have another. But there are details. So of course there's another thing that Udo is. Probably has already mentioned that in equilibrium, the fluctuation dissipation is like this. The kick sum system response is equal to fluctuation, but in the non-equilibrium system, and it's not the same. The response is not directly equal to the fluctuation, but has this residual term, which is associated with this rotational force. So you kick the system, it's not going to be, the response and the fluctuations are not going to be the same. And the residual term is this. So, and of course, there's another thing which is essentially the there's also a thermodynamic aspect of this, which is that the usual case, if you have detailed balance, then what happens is that your free energy change, the relaxation, and the entropy production is the same. Essentially, right? Maybe you relax, you dissipate, and that's the entropy production. But if you have this detail balance broken, then you have another term, which is sort of maintaining the steady state. So then the non-equilibrium part has two parts. One is relax to the steady state, the other is to maintain the steady state. The steady state needs the energy to maintain that. And this the maintenance is determined by this flux, the flux force. Of course, there's another interesting thing. There is some geometrical aspect related to that, which is that there's a apparent, as I said. I mean, this you can look at the symmetry and think about this as a gauge field. Because if you talk about the electric magnetic analogy, then all the intuitively you would expect some kind of gauge field. And so it turns out that there's an intrinsic gauge field curvature which is related to these to whether or not detail balance is broken. So in other words, detail balance broken or input out of the energy is related to some kind of geometrical quantity like general relativity. When you have flat space, you can always move things around. But if you have a curved space, then if you do the parallel moving, you go around itself, you have an angle, sort of a deficit angle because the intrinsic curvature. So this tells you there's some kind of geometrical connection there, but that's
the question on the previous slide.
The
housekeeping, can you give a little bit of an example of what is?
Oh, so this is essentially the velocity JSS over PSS, JSS over PSS. This is the diffusion inverse of the diffusion coefficient. So basically, this is the heat maintaining the steady state. So the steady state needs some energy, stress, cause some energy to maintain, even the steady state. The equilibrium doesn't have to, but the steady state, non-equilibrium steady state requires maintenance. So,
Wait, so the
V is the JSS over PSS.
Okay, so in equilibrium system, JSS equals zero in steady state.
Yeah, therefore it's zero. There's nothing there. Yeah. Okay.
But so in the steady state, non-equilibrium steady state, the housekeeping heat dissipation is the same as EPR.
Because DFDT equals zero. However, if you look at the time dependence, the EPR is partitioned to two. One is the time dependence, and one is the maintain. Yes.
But you're talking about the steady state.
Yes, if we talk about the steady state, there's only one contribution. So if we look at the cell, the biological example, the cell cycle, and so this is a good example to show that. And we know that through many studies that, for example, this is a mammalian cell cycle is determined by this underlying gene regulatory network, but one can write down the corresponding dynamics. And how do we look at that from this perspective? So the way to look at that, this is the normal sort of cell cycle. You go through G0, G1, S, G2 phase, and you go through the cycle through some checkpoints. So now, if I look at the dynamics and look at the probabilistic version of that, solve the probabilistic equation, and then I got a steady state solution, right? And of course, through that decomposition, I can know both the flux component and the potential component, minus log of the steady state probability distribution. And these are the two components that I choose to project on. So this is the first component, the global landscape, is just like what we are interested in, that in the sort of global landscape of this network, the gene regulatory network, the cell cycle.
So the transition states are in terms of gene expression levels?
Yes.
For genes in the cell cycle?
The gene expressions, gene expression levels, yeah. So this is gene expression levels, yeah, this is the landscape. And what you see is globally, this is like inhomogeneous.
Well, the axes are the gene expression
level. Yeah, the axes are the gene expression level. The arrows I'm going to explain a little bit later. So this is the landscape, the one component of the driving force, the landscape, global landscape, it characterizes the weight of the state space. So this is a sort of a global characterization. So what you can see, this is an inhomogeneous Mexican hat, the shape. So if you are at any places on this state space, of the expression state space, then you are going to get attracted by this gradient, right, to this lower potential part, right? So this essentially attracts you down to this lower potential part. And it's essentially, this is the circular trajectory of the cell cycle. So that guarantees the sort of stability of these states. However, once you are on that track, then you can see that it will be more feasible, more probable that they are going to stay at the lower potential rather than the other places. And if it's just the gradient force, then they're going to all be staying here, right? Not going anywhere. They're going to be all staying here. But in fact, the cell cycle persists. So this means that this purple line represents the other component of the driving force, which is the flux. So once you are on that trajectory, it is the flux that drives the stable flow of this process. I mean, you need this driving force to drag you out of the low potential barrier and to go around. So that's one thing that it comes out from this picture. And the other thing is we talk about that there are different phases, the G1, S, G2, and M phases. And this correspond to, along the line, you have local basins, right? Local basins along the line. And between them, you have barriers, and that corresponds to the sort of transition state between the local basins. one of the things that you can find out, because this is the driving force of the flow, then naturally this driving force is directly related to the speed of the cell cycle, because of this driving force. And one would wonder what's the origin of this driving force in terms of the cell cycle context, and that's the nutrition supply. If you don't give much of a nutrition, you'll stay here. You're not going to go anywhere. But if you start to drive the system harder and harder with the nutrition supply, and then you will finally just complete the size.
The plot, the color plot corresponds to the landscape, right?
Yes.
Can you, on the same plot, also show the vorticity? Is it uniform or is it just?
Well, here, the reason why I show here the flux here is that it's more effective here.
No, I'm just saying you can.
Yes, I can, because that's a vector at every point.
So if it's two dimensional, you can write as a curl of some. Can you write as the effective the sort of vorticity in that space, in two dimensional space, and see? I mean, all I'm saying is that you see landscape.
Yeah.
But if you show vorticity, is it uniform?
No.
Or is it also centered somewhere?
Yeah,
along the trajectory.
Yeah, it's not uniform. It depends on where you are. Yeah. It's inhomogeneous. Go ahead.
In this particular case, the two coordinates are sufficient, right?
Yes.
So did you do some projection from some originally higher dimensional space to get there?
Yes.
And that's reasonably unique. Which kind of tool?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That, definitely. So there are two ways of doing that. One is just according to the experimental sort of measurements, where they measure these several coordinates and then you use this. And that's what we do. But on the other hand, you can also use like things like a PCA and things like that to project and then do the thing. The important thing is that, you know, of course, different projections may give you different results, though. So, and then it matters which angle you are looking at that. And especially from the experiments, I mean, which observables, I mean, it does depend on which observables you use to project.
I mean, you need some time scale separation for that really to work, right?
Yes.
Because if you had originally three or four components, and they are all on the same time scale, then you don't end up with this Markovian description in two dimensions.
Right. So essentially, you can sort of reduce, I mean, of course, you approximate that, reduce the high dimension into several, exactly like you said, time scale separation, reduce the, essentially get rid of the fast, and just only look at the slowest one. So, yes, that's what we do,
Can I just make sure I understand how you're constructing all of this? So you start with some set of ODEs describing the reactions for a bunch of different components.
Sure.
And you solve those for a long time, right? And you say, okay, there's my steady state distribution.
Sure.
And then what you're doing here is you're saying, I'm going to choose two of the species in my thing, and I'm going to look at the log probabilities of those functional concentration in the steady state. And then, so then you fixed your gauge through the choice that you previously made, and that gives you all of the information for this, but I mean, so this path that you construct in purple, like, where is that coming from?
Oh, that's just the steady state flux, probability flux, the direction of that. This is the purple line.
Starting from some particular point, starting from the global minimum.
The directions at each point. Yeah. I sort of connect the line, but it doesn't have to be. Yes, go ahead.
And couldn't you do the analysis there directly in higher dimension rather than projecting in 2D?
I can do it in the high dimension, but it's hard to visualize. I mean, so
the result would be different.
Say it again.
The result would be different, right?
I couldn't understand what
the result of the analysis would be different.
Yeah, the result is in high dimensions, but in order to visualize that, you have to project to a certain low dimension.
That's the same question another way, right? Yeah. Like if you were to just construct the path from the minimum, right? Just construct a path in high dimension, and then use the same projection to go to these two coordinates. Is the path the same as what you get here? In general, the answer is no. I would expect it to be no here, right?
Well, as I said, this is a visualization, right? So you can have the results and you can analyze the result, but if you want to visualize, you have to determine what to project. I mean, so in order to see the things,
I guess the question.
Yeah.
For me is, I mean, are you going to get better information about, say, rates or other things by doing everything in high dimension, and then, you know, for visualization purposes later, you can project down, but like, if you wanted to extract information about time scales from
this, No. I mean, like, if you talk about the path and the rates, I would rather do it in high dimensions. Yeah, because, here's the one thing. Although it's multidimensional, if you look at the path, it's actually one-dimensional.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like bad. I mean, that thing, but it's one-dimensional, so it's not so bad. I mean, after all, if you look at the path, it's reasonably simple. I mean, if you look at the path, so that's why you can do multidimensional, because you can just doing the one-dimensional path.
So this particular thing has one basin of attraction, right?
No, actually a few basins. I mean, this is the global basin, but there are some local basins. Yeah.
But they are all interconnected?
Interconnected.
Because if you didn't draw the path, I kind of see all the basins as connected. So it is a larger basin with a complex, I would say, a higher dimension basin, not the local basin of attraction.
Which one you're thinking?
I'm talking about the blue one on the bottom.
This one, right?
Yeah.
Because this is the G1 phase, which is the dominant basin. If you don't have nutrition supply, they're going to sit there. Yeah, this is the dominant phase. Okay.
Just had one question to try to understand. Yeah. So the landscape there is, that's sort of defined by the noise in the system, right? So if everything was really noisy, that would just become flat, more or less, I guess.
No, I mean, so you can take the zero noise limit, right? I mean, so you can still have this shape. I mean, it's not going to be completely flat if you have a zero noise limit. It's not going to be.
Zero noise.
Yeah, if you take the zero.
I'm thinking of this infinite noise limit.
Infinite noise. Well, infinite noise limit. Of course, then everything becomes flat. I mean, because you can easily go from one.
But I'm just thinking of in terms of biology.
So
with more noise in the system, that's going to, the gradients aren't going to be as strong.
It's going to be, it depends. I would say if you. This has something to do with the definition. If you take the potential as the minus log of p, yes. But if you take, you have this noise at the bottom, at the denominator, then there is a sort of intrinsic one which is less dependent on the noise. So it depends on which one you're using. If you use the probability, if you increase the noise, the probability landscape, I mean, we call that probability landscape, it becomes flatter. But if you have the usual.
You want to keep the cell cycle going, so I guess what I was trying to get at is that, does this make some prediction about sort of the minimum number of cell cycle proteins that ought to be in the cell?
Can you repeat that?
Well, I guess I'm viewing the noise would decrease with the number of cell cycles, the actual protein molecules in the cell.
The interesting thing is it also has something to do with how much energy you put in. So very often you see that if you put in a lot of energy, you suppress the, sort of effectively suppress the noise. I mean, they act like, you know, you hammer that down to the noise. So if you
do it right.
Yeah, of course. I mean, if you do it,
you can also amplify the noise.
How do you get the noise? Is that the noise which you get from the chemical master equation in that continuum limit? And if yes, it presumably will depend on
the concentration.
Spatially.
Yeah. No, for this particular, well, we did it in two ways, but for this particular work, we just put adding noise, I mean, sort of the additive noise.
Because, additive noise.
Yeah, additive noise.
Artificially.
Yeah, yes, additive noise. But of course, in principle, you can do that with the kinetic master equation.
So you didn't do the whole Gillespie? Story.
No. I didn't do the Gillespie here because the equation. The reason why, this is a eukaryotic cell, mammalian cell. You have many molecules there. So usually this intrinsic noise is not that significant. Okay, go ahead.
Pretty naive question here. First, the purple lines, is that steady state solutions corresponding to the cell cycle? The purple lines, yes.
The purple line is the steady state probability flux. It represents the steady state probability flux.
Also, it's not actually concentration. It's not actually...
The purple line, no, it's the vector. I mean, it's the flux, the other component of the driving force.
But the trajectory, if you get rid of the noise,
yeah.
Look at the mean field trajectory,
yeah.
Would it actually be similar? Or
it would be similar. You still, I mean, the interesting thing is if you take the zero noise limit, the gradient force and the flux are perpendicular to each other.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
They are not if the noise is not zero.
So one question.
Yeah.
Then does it mean you have a family of those flux curves, because you are showing one particular probability, correct, and the direction of the flux.
Yes, I mean, so you mean if I draw a smaller or a bigger one, you're talking about, yeah. Well, I mean,
they don't cross, or they should not cross.
I mean, so, that's interesting because if you. I mean, we did that in the sort of a discretized case, not in this continuous case, that you can actually. So this flux, I mean, this is a detail balance breaking one. In fact, you can. There's some mathematical way of doing that. You can actually decompose them. Because here we say this is divergent free, it's rotational. But in the discrete space, it's a cycle, right? I mean, in the discrete state space. In fact, you can decompose that into a finite number of loops, like what you said. I mean, so you have a big loop, small loop, and etc. Each loop carries different fluxes. Yes. They're in the discrete representation, we are able to do that. Yes. And since I'm not going to talk about this, so let me just say the conclusion there is that, so in principle, if you have a detailed balance breaking, then you have a chance of creating the cycles. But whether or not these cycles will become realizable or sort of become prominent depends on whether or not this one cycle, for example, is dominating compared to the other. So it's like one standing out of many, that is a limit cycle. If two standing out from the ocean of many, it becomes two limit cycles. And things like that, but now you have a chance of creating the cycles. I mean, or the oscillations. Yes.
I'm trying to understand the impact of the vortexes,
yes.
Where they come from, and what they mean,
yeah.
For sort of
if
you took any given cell and you projected its trajectory on there. So do those vortexes mean that essentially, if you took a population of cells?
Yeah.
If you have a stronger vortex at some place, you might fall, you basically might be more in the yellow than the blue. So we need any one cell may take a different path.
Yes, I mean, so if you, if you have no vortices, you just go, for example, the straight. But if you have vortices, you will go this way or go that way.
So are the vortexes, they're a property of the system of equations that's describing, in this case, the cell cycle regulatory network.
Yes.
So another way to say that would be, like, or I guess, does the cell cycle have smaller vortexes than some other networks might.
The cell cycle should have a big one because
it should have a lot.
Oh, yeah, because otherwise you wouldn't generate a cycle oscillation.
No, I don't understand that, but that's probably.
No, in order to have a global sort of a cycle oscillation, you need to have a strong vorticity. Right? I mean, if you have weak vorticity, how are we able to generate a big cycle oscillation? I mean, the cycle oscillation needs a strong vortex force, but there are small vortex force around it once you have detailed balance breaking in the dynamics. But whether or not you will have a cycle oscillation, that depends on how big this vortex.
That's why I want you to plot that vorticity on the same plot here, because what happened in the bottom, I mean, if you're in the equilibrium system without the cycle, what happened that you just fall down the hill, and you stay at the bottom of the hill, and you stay there, because there's no other force. The force there is zero. You're not going anywhere. In the presence of the vortex, now you have, once you are there, you actually can go along the direction that the vortex is telling you to go. So if you plot that probably the point, so that's probably each local minimum, probably correspond to one of the spaces in the So once you stay there long enough, this vortex, the force due to the vortex will kick you out.
Yep.
And you go to the next one.
Yep. Yep.
And you stay comfortable there for
a bit, and
you be kicked out again.
Yep. That's the picture. Yes, go ahead.
So in the world of muscle mechanics, there are these plots of force as a function of extension, and you get cycles. Uh-huh. And the area enclosed in the cycles is the work done, or the work by the muscle or on the muscle. Do you have any sort of similar energetic argument for the area of the loop that you're drawing in the space?
Absolutely. That's the heat dissipation. Yes, that's absolutely. Because there is a little bit different representation for that case, because what happened is that here we are talking about one landscape you have this vorticity, but there you are talking about two landscapes, right? So one is, this is the chemical space, and this is the state, the whatever the concentration or the x, right? So you are doing something like this, right? This is the cycle. So you're doing between two landscapes for the muscle case, because one is the mechanical, this is the chemical state space. So it is
talking about force times distance diagrams.
You're talking about the
force times distance, which is just kinetic power.
Oh, okay, yeah, but.
I do not agree with your statement that this area here has something to do with the dissipation. I mean, the dissipation is the square of each of these arrows integrated over the whole landscape.
It's the J square.
integrated over the whole thing. Yeah. That has nothing to do with the area of your kind of limit cycle.
That's the entropy production rate. Yes. That's actually related to the entropy production rate.
The area.
No. The J square divided by D.
Yes.
Integrate exactly. Over D. Yeah.
My question was, since you mentioned that the noise is small anyways, right, in this problem.
It's small.
So if the noise is small, what is gained by going through all this rather than just plotting the original F, the deterministic forces, which would yield a similar picture, and from which you would then see the limit cycle emerging.
Yeah. Oh, because
really gained by going through all this in the limit of small noise.
Oh, okay. So the thing is, now you can see that there are like two components, right? The driving force. One is the landscape like what we have. The other is the sort of the.
But this is a little bit artificial because you introduce this landscape through the log of the stationary distribution. Uh-huh. I mean, I wouldn't have to do this. In the load noise limit, I could just look at the deterministic dynamics in this two-dimensional space, and I would see that limit cycle, right?
But how do you? You won't see this kind of landscape, right? I mean, you see this limit cycle trajectories, right?
Yeah,
think I haven't really understood why I need a landscape at all.
Wouldn't the landscape be sort of telling you at the limit how long, the speed also, right?
That's the flux. I mean, it's
yeah, the flux.
Yeah.
Landscape doesn't.
That's the point that we were making.
The point is that it is not zero noise. Okay, it has some noise.
Yes.
So the bump means something, even though your trajectory doesn't pass through there. The middle guy there, the red bump, you have to be there. If it's totally flat, imagine your trajectory would not be too stable, even given the small noise.
I'm not saying that it's totally flat. I'm saying you don't have to go through this. If you have your original dynamics, x dot is f of x, and you plot that f, that would be a little arrow in this two-dimensional space.
Yeah, yeah, you can have the
force. Same kind of picture. The length of your arrow would tell you how long you're in that particular point.
Right, but you would not know anything other than the points nearby or along the trajectory. Yeah. You don't know how often you're going to visit there.
Because the length of your arrows will tell you how long you spent there in the dynamics.
Along the trajectory, but not in the middle of the. You see the bump, the red bump, right? You're not going to know anything about the red bump.
The arrows
I do.
Yeah,
I do.
Not okay. You can do perturbation and see, but I don't know. You do? Yeah. is he doing a non-local study with the finite noise?
Okay, well, let
you just know anything around the trajectory.
Okay. Let me say something about the information we can get out from this. It's because the middle island, the height of the middle island, and this global flux and the barrier, just you have mentioned the barrier height, and we can do a global sensitivity analysis. For example, I can ask how sensitive, for example, like the speed, how sensitive about these regulations, like regulation parameters, are sensitive towards moving this around, and how is that related to the speed of the cell cycle? And that would be the sort of the global one, because these sort of thing you can only get from this kind of analysis, and that is related to the speed of the cell cycle. And if you go back to say which regulations are important, you can actually see that not all of them are important, but some of them are critical. The backbone of these circuit. These are the backbone of the circuit, determines the very crucial for determining the cell cycle.
Sensitivity analysis that like original model ODEs rather than converting into the landscape
Yeah, but what I'm saying here is now you have a way of characterizing these are the target, your target, this is the height of that. Because if this height is low, then you can easily go from here to here without going through this place. You lose the coherence of the cycle. So
if you look at the landscape, right? Yeah. I mean, and your axes actually are cycling B, I see, meaningful genes.
Yes.
And you also see that the structure of the landscape, let's say in the very right lower corner, that minimum is very sharp.
Yeah, yeah.
So the curvature there is very high. So do you have any interpretation of why the landscape has such a large curvature there, whereas the other minima are very shallower but broader?
This is a very stable one.
Can you say something about the biology behind it?
Well, I mean, so essentially what happened is that if you don't supply any nutrition, they were all going to stay here. Actually, the shape of the landscape changes according to the energetic input. So if you have nothing, the shape is not going to be like this. This is a whole basin like this. So if you increase the energy input or the nutrition supply, the shape gradually changes to be like that. You need a certain energy input or the nutrition supply to have something like this.
Given this particular energy supply, whatever level that you have, you see the minima near the right corner is very different from the local minima there, which is much shallower.
Yeah, the GY is always it's always a very stable place.
And this could be probably some reason.
Yeah, they also, you, if you have any perturbations, you jump and you always go back to GY. And this seems to be the
But doesn't it mean that it just stays there for a long time?
Yes.
Yeah.
It stays there for a long time. There's little driving force out of this.
Yeah.
In the F picture, that would be very narrow arrow. I mean, very small arrow.
Small arrow. That's why it's deeper because of a.
But
that is information, right? So that's probably coming out of some either biology or some parameter you choose in the model.
Yeah. So. I would say the biology is quite designed quite robustly around the G1. I mean, G1 seems to be the basis of everything. So, in other words, you can say that cell is a single basin attraction to begin with. But in order to force that to be in the cycle loop, you need to pump, you need to act and pump in a lot of energy to it. To form a cycle. So that's the form, the basic design, and which is related to this single cell, because the single cell for evolution, then you want to have the biggest growth, right? I mean, the single cell bacteria want to grow. I mean, the speed of the cell cycle is correlated very, very much with the energy input. If you don't have energy, and this is, it will sit here at the G1, it won't have a cycle, and therefore it won't grow. I mean, the division, there's no division, no growth. So there's a threshold you have to go over, and the larger that you put in, the bigger the growth. So this is related to the theme of this conference. You need energy input to go. You need enough energy to create this landscape to go around. And that gives you the growth. Otherwise, you won't even have a growth, because growth is equivalent to the division in the unicellular organism, like this.
Okay. So, one quick question. So, is this a probability landscape determined completely computationally, or is there any empirical sort of support for that as well?
This is a computational result. This is a computational result, but there are some of the things are consistent with the experimental studies. Yes.
When you take this two-dimensional slice, is it possible that it's one cycle within a larger cycle, in the sense that, I don't know how to describe this, but you could imagine that as this goes around, it's moving around in another,
When you do the projection, of course, when you do the low-dimensional production, anything can happen. But for this case, I mean, in the multi-dimensional, we solve the multi-dimensional case. You have the equation of motion already. You know that cycle is. But in this projection, there's no sort of this kind of complexity.
I guess my question is a little bit more naive in that, how do you know that corresponds to the cell cycle and not some sub-cycle within the cell cycle?
It goes through the whole state space, right? I mean, so
in this slice, it does.
Yes.
But it could have just gone through. So, like, I guess. Like, one check that for this would be, does the average time it takes to go around correspond to the length of the cell cycle?
Yeah.
Or is it much faster?
You know, of course, that's a good check, so to see if they are consistent, yes. Yeah. Definitely. Okay, so I'm not going to go through these other things, like, for example, the cancer and the stem cell differentiation and development things. Michael is here, just mention briefly, I mean, similar idea you can apply to the evolution, which is the thing that I mentioned, that Wright's adaptive evolution idea is also saying that evolution dynamics is determined by the landscape gradient. It's called adaptive landscape. However, the Wright works out the cases in very specialized cases where you have this situation. You can write down the selection force as a gradient. But in some more complicated cases, like even for the single locus multi-allele case, you could have allele frequency dependent selection, even for that simple case. Means that you have the interactions depends on these concentrations. So I mean, in the language we just talked about, in that case you cannot have a pure gradient. So you can have this. You need to have the flux. And what's important there is, for example, in the evolution, you could have a co-evolution, like a physical environment doesn't change, but you have a co-evolution, like, for example, predator and prey. So you can easily form a cycle like that. And in that case, you can think about that as an example. Another way of looking at that is the cycle. And this cycle has been sort of proposed by this guy Van Valen, and this is some people use that as a criticism of the Wright Fisher, because if you have a cycle, if you can form a cycle, then obviously you cannot explain that purely by a gradient, right? Because if you have a gradient, then you go back to yourself. I mean, which one is higher and which one is lower? So. And Van Valen called that a Red Queen hypothesis. And so you sort of never stop in order to survive and sort of keep on running. And this kind of scheme can be used to explain that. And especially we derive a formula, which I didn't put it on, is that the genetic variation is called in the Wright Fisher's, in the Fisher's language, is usually related to this adaptive rate. But when the adaptive rate is sort of the landscape, reaches the optimal, then in the right official language, it should stop. I mean, there's no genetic variation, but in fact, you can see the genetic variation still there. And that the reason why it's there is because you have this gradient force supporting it. You can have the cooperation, the the allele frequency dependent selection gives you the cooperation and the interactions. Once you have the interactions, then epistasis, for example, in the multi-locus case, and then you could easily have another sort of the driving force for evolution, not just the adaptive landscape, but also this rotational force. And that can generate the cycle oscillation that can give you this the Red Queen hypothesis from a different angle, because the people also explain that the landscape has to be time dependent. It's from a different angle, but this doesn't have to be time dependent. Even for the steady state landscape, if you have this this rotational component, you can also generate a cycle and that gives you the Red Queen. But anyway, so there are some other applications I just listed. But let me, for the time being, let me give you a few, I mean, this is all about the theoretical and computational studies, give you a quick glance about some experimental quantification of the landscape and the flux, because we talk about these two forces very, quite a bit. So the first thing is very, very simple and naive. Think about a one gene case. If we want to characterize the landscape of one gene, I mean, the way to do it is to look at, for example, attached to a fluorescence protein and look at the intensity, and not only the average intensity, but also the intensity fluctuations and the intensity distributions. That's the intensity. If we got the intensity fluctuations and especially the histogram and the count histogram, then we can invert that to the landscape minus log of the probability, steady state probability distribution. That's the idea, to quantify the landscape that way. And this seems to be a very simple one, because self repressor is just a repress, so you just should have very naive result. So what we decided to do is to see. Exactly, somebody asked me earlier the question is that if, I mean, this seemed to be a very naive one, but in fact, it's not necessary because that, as I said, in the adiabatic limit, if you produce a protein, gene produce protein immediately repress the genes, then yes, you expect one repressed state. But if you somehow perturb the system or slow down this process, then you might expect, even for self-repressed, a very simple system, you might expect a two state instead of one. I mean, that's sort of a non-adiabatic part. I mean, this is the model system we use. So essentially what we do is exactly this system, but instead of just let it go, like this is the bacteria, so you have the genes that connecting with the fluorescence protein that labels that, so you can see the fluorescence light, and once the protein is produced, they repress. However, now you put some inducers to essentially disrupt the binding process, effectively slow down the process. And we want to see if you increase the induction, whether or not you will see two states. In fact, if you increase the concentration of these inducers, then gradually you will see from the one peak to the two peak situation. And you can follow that in the real time. So you can see the bright and the dark. So you can clearly see the distinction between the two states. So this is a rather simple one. Here's the real-time trajectory. You can see the dancing between the high and the low intensity states. And of course, if you look at the histogram, you do see low and high expression states. So which means that you have a quantification of the landscape. So by playing around with this adiabaticity and non-adiabaticity, you can see one or two states. And this kind of game you can play for two genes, not one gene, a two-gene regulatory network. This is a typical example. This is called bacterial lambda phage, where you have two genes repressing each other instead of activating or whatever. And these two genes repress C1 and CRO repressing each other. And this is such a classical system in the molecular biology and has been studied by many, many, many people. And this system, the wild type system, is very robust. It turns out to be very robust. Only one state appears usually. You hardly see another state. And it's very difficult to see the switching between these two states, because if you mutually repress, you expect either one dominates or the other dominates. But in fact, because this is the stability, you usually only see one, not the other. Even for the genetic engineer, when you insert into the chromosome of the bacteria, usually you don't see both states in coexistence. And of course, not the switching between them. I mean, it's just one state. So by doing some tricks here, we labeled these two genes with two. Usually, people label with the two different kinds of proteins. Now you have two different colors. You can look at their dynamics. But here, instead, we mark with only one color. The reason why we do so is because if you want to trace the real-time dynamics, if you use two colors, and then usually they have different maturation times, and so it's very hard to distinguish one from the other, especially if you want to understand the dynamics in the same time, right? Because it's very hard to calibrate that. And so if you use one color, you don't have this problem. But then how do you distinguish them with the two genes? And the way to do it is, one is you connect with the one protein, which is called the Venus. And it has the property that they like to sit on the membrane of the protein. And the other one likes to sit in the sort of the middle of the cell. So by location, you can distinguish these two. And this is the trick to do. The other trick to do is to realize, because this is the wild type, as I said, is very bad, because it's one is very stable, the other, it's very difficult to see both. And so the way to do it is to adjust the affinity of these and the strength of the binding size so that to balance these two, so that you will be able to see that. And another important thing is that this is to balance the affinity, the stability. The other thing is very important. The reason why you only see one state is because you can see in this language is that the barrier is too high. And in order to do that, the wild type is not necessarily the great thing. And we do a temperature mutation. And if you do a temperature mutation, the effective one is to lower down the barrier. So the purpose is to see both states. And so now, I mean, here is the histogram of the distance. So you can see the location of these two same color proteins are separated. So you can see, and actually in the real image, you can see that at a lower temperature, you actually are mostly C1, which is on the side of the cell. But in the middle temperature, you see something on the side, also in the middle. But if you use higher temperature, they are mostly in the middle. So the location. And the interesting thing in the real-time measurements, you can see the different colors corresponds to different states. And so we can see that this is the real-time trace, several real-time trace. You can see that, and this is the C1, this is the crow. And you can see that, surprisingly, I mean, we expect this C1, the crow, has two states. One is the C1 dominance, and the other is the crow dominance. But in fact, you can see not only you have the one dominates the other, so this one is dominate, such as the green, and one dominates, and the other dominates the blue, is dominated by the crow. But you also have others like purple that both are very big, right? So this is another state that appeared. And you also have, the red, which is basically nothing. Both have nothing. So consistently you have actually four states in the real time, rather than only two states. This is surprising. And so if you look at C1, and it's a crow and C1, by collecting the histogram, you actually see four states. The 0, 0, and the C1 dominant, crow dominant, and there's also a C1, both C1 and the crow are significant. And from the real-time trace, you can deduce not only this is the histogram, so this is essentially the landscape. You have four states. Not only that, you can also, from the real-time trace, with the hidden Markov chain, you can actually check the switching time going from one to the other. And the interesting thing that happened, well, first of all, of course, now there are four states instead of two, I mean, from the classical states. On the other hand, for the lambda phage. On the other hand, it's important to know that this going from C1 to crow, or crow back to C1, is not like what we expect, that they go directly from one to the other. Because the directly going from one to the other is just very long. It's incredibly long. They actually go through this intermediate states. It's more likely to go through this intermediate state. So that's sort of the picture that we can see for this system, I mean, the engineered system.
Does one have the lifetime distributions in the four states? Is it kind of mono-exponential? Is it mono-exponential?
It's fixed by the exponential. Yeah, it's fixed by the exponential. Okay, so this is the sort of the landscape characterization. What about the flux? And this is the last piece that I would like to share with you. So in order to find this quantity is more involved than just the landscape, because landscape is the histogram collection. Here we look at a single molecule enzymatic reaction. So this is the usual Michaelis-Menten scheme, right? And so you derive the Michaelis-Menten rate, and I think Professor Leif talked about that already in details today. So the inverse of the rate is related to the inverse of the substrate concentration. And so that's the Michaelis-Menten law. And this has been derived a long time ago, and also has been tested by many experiments. Now, what we are interested in is a model system where this may not work. But to do that, we actually look at a system where you, instead of catalyze one substrate, we catalyze two substrates. So this is the so the horseradish peroxide is the enzyme, and these are the two substrates. So you first catalyze one substrate, which is the dehydrorhodamine 1,2,3, and after that, you catalyze using horseradish, same horseradish peroxide, to catalyze the other other substrate. It's hydrogen peroxide. And the whole thing you can understand with a scheme like this, reaction scheme like this. So in the first, this horseradish peroxide, this enzyme has several different conformations, 1,2 conformations. And what happens is this is the catalytic reaction, you go to this stage, and then you form the product, then this is through the rhodamine 1,2,3. Then go through another route. You catalyze another reaction, and the hydrogen peroxide catalyze the hydrogen peroxide, generate the water out, and you go back. So this is the kinetic scheme. This is the two conformation of the enzymes. This is the product for the first catalytic reaction, and this is the second. So for this reaction scheme, then one can prove that you can form a loop, right? You know, a loop like that. And if the flux is zero, then you can have a Michaelis-Menten rate. You can recover the Michaelis-Menten rate. However, if the flux is not equal to zero, then the rate, it's not simply having a functional form like that. It has this reminiscence of the Michaelis-Menten rate, but it also has a residual part over here. So that's the case. So this is the reaction scheme. So to observe this, so you have this single molecule measurement with the enzyme here and the substrate coming into the laser focal plane, and you register the trace, and you do the correlations for the trajectories, and then from the correlations you can go back and figure out all these different kinetics directly from the correlations. And what happened is that if you look at the inverse of the rate, enzymatic rate, versus the substrate, the inverse of the substrate concentration, what happened is that this straight line, I mean, you expect a straight line for Michaelis-Menten. I mean, that's what you expect, right? But in fact, the experimental result shows that it's obviously not, they are not straight lines, and different. This is a different second substrate concentrations. They are very much deviating from there. They're very much deviating from there. So this is the first evidence of non-Michaelis-Menten behavior for this system, where you have catalyzed two substrates and clearly showing that. And of course, that's the case, if from the kinetic kinetic scheme, we just mentioned that this indicates that there is a flux that presents that breaks this the Michaelis-Menten rate. Yeah, go ahead.
So from the, can you go back to the scheme for kinetics?
Yeah.
So from this scheme, it's not clear to me that you would expect Michaelis-Menten kinetics at all, right?
Right.
I mean if you, the a priori, it shouldn't be surprising that this isn't Michaelis-Menten, right?
Well, Michaelis-Menten is very common, but non-Michaelis-Menten is not as common. So the system that we are studying, that's the motivation of using this system to see.
I guess like when you have these off-pathway reactions, right? The kinetic scheme is different from the one that you get with Michaelis-Menten kinetics. So, like the dynamics of the system are just different from the Michaelis-Menten dynamics.
Well, it's catalyzing two substrates. Right?
Yeah.
But if you have there are several conditions. If you have the one conformation, you still have the Michaelis-Menten. So this is the same. So you need to have different conformations, but you also need to have the detail balance breaking in order to generate non-Michaelis-Menten.
J, the flux, which one does it control? Control lambda? Control C2? When you go, can you go?
Oh, both.
So which one goes to zero? So both of them go to zero? Or when J goes to zero?
C2 goes to zero.
But lambda will just asymptote
to some values.
To some value.
So, I mean, of course, you can derive that the chemical potential from that is pretty much like a constant. I mean, it does fluctuate, but it's pretty much a constant. So you have some kind of chemical potential driving force for this. And of course, you can also calculate the entropy production based on the things that you have observed. And this because the flux is not equal to zero, as Udo mentioned, the J square integration gets you the EPR. So and because this entropy production or the thermodynamic cost of this is not zero. I mean, this is highly non-equilibrium driving force. So essentially, what we do here is you can get a non-Michaelis-Menten rate, and the deviation is actually caused by this the non-zero flux, the detail balance break, and that could give you some the origin of this driving force, the chemical potential, and that can be verified by the heat measurement. So you can have the heat measurement and determine that it's absorption reactions. And also, this will give you something I didn't talk about. There's a ton of irreversibility coming out from this. This is directly related to this. I guess I'm running out of time, and so there's something that we can compare the equilibrium and the non-equilibrium at the end. So equilibrium, you have the probability is determined by the interaction energy, and which is related to the probability. And in non-equilibrium, we are looking at the emergent steady state probability. And the equilibrium, we look at the energy landscape, and in non-equilibrium, we look at the potential non-equilibrium potential landscape. And the detail balance is zero. No detail balance. There is a preserved detail balance in equilibrium system. But you have broken detail balance here in the non-equilibrium system. The dynamics is gradient in equilibrium, and in the non-equilibrium you have both gradient and the rotational force. And the kinetic rate, you have the transition state theory, but now you have modified the transition state. You have to go to different parts of the landscape. And the path is a reversible gradient path, but pass here in the non-equilibrium is irreversible, not through the transition state, the typical transition state. fluctuation dissipation theorem. This is the response fluctuation is around the equilibrium, and this is the response fluctuation is around the steady state. And then you need an additional force, the flux correlation. Some of the dynamics, you have first law and also the second law. Essentially, we have this the entropy production in the dynamical process is equal to the free energy dissipation, and here the entropy production has to be used for two things. One is the relaxation of the free energy. The other is the maintaining of the steady state. So the cell cycle, and we have this example that you need both forces driving the stable points, using for driving the stables to stabilize the states. The other one is for stabilize the flow. So and of course we talk about some applications for the evolution and other things, differentiation and cancer. So I guess the message is simple. It's basically in the non-equilibrium dynamics, you need both. You need both to globally describe the dynamics. So we can use this to, since it's global, we can use this to infer the underlying physical mechanism and also find that some key elements of the networks for design and control. So I have benefited from many discussions with my graduate students now and postdocs now. Many of them have their own independent positions all over the place for the theory part, but also from the experimental part, which we just started the efforts on the simple systems and the look at some global quantifications. Thank you for your attention.